homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dhamma, homage to the Sangha. Good morning, everybody. Please sit down. The unsurpassed, penetrating and perfect truth is seldom met with, even in 100,000 myriad kalpas. Now we can see and hear it, we can remember and accept it. I vow to make the Buddha's truth one with myself. Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. So we just had our Avatamsaka ceremony, a whole ceremony devoted to a scripture, not a Buddha, not a Bodhisattva, a scripture. And you think, why have a whole ceremony about a scripture? Well, if you look at it, you'll see because it's vast, it's really long, it's really big, it's really profound. It's an amazing thing. Nobody knows who wrote it. It could have been a bunch of people because it's so... I can't imagine one person being able to write all that. The first 50 pages are about who's there. You know, the Buddha's preaching the scripture. 50 pages about all the people who are there, or beings, Gandharvas, Maharagas, and all this. I've done talks on the Avatamsaka in the past, but I'm not going to do one today, not exactly. What I used to do, though, I'd just dive in and fish out a little bit and talk about that. And even that was just a tiny bit of what was involved in that little jewel. There's so many facets to all that's in the Avatamsaka. It's like a huge net. Every little bit reflects all the other bits. And it's just vast. So you can just dive in and fish out a little thing and contemplate it. It's always really, all of it is really deep and also practical. It's not just stuff that's way beyond us. It's things we can actually put into practice. Otherwise, there'll be no point. It's for us. The Dharma is for us. All the teachings are for us. The one and the many and the one. The universal within all things and all our little things within that. Just together. Well, today I'd like to talk about the vastness of the Dharma, how huge it is. I mean, it's huger than we can really imagine. The Avatamsaka itself, as I said, is vast, enormous in its scope and its depth, and it's just beyond what a little human mind could really fathom. So there's something that must come through a person writing a scripture, or writing it down, is that almost like it's not, they're not composing something. It's like it comes through them. When Reverend Master Hubert used to translate, he would say, something comes through. It comes through. You know, like Dogen, coming through. He didn't take any great credit for this. He would just make himself a pipe for whatever was coming through. And the Avatamsaka is like this. It's so vast. Little brain couldn't encompass all this stuff. It must just come through, you know. As I said, and maybe a number of people, not just one. The vastness of the Dharma, its limitless nature. The Bodhisattva vows are huge. The third of them is, however limitless the Dharma may be, I vow to comprehend it completely. All the Bodhisattva vows are really big, or however innumerable beings may be, I vow to say them all. However inexhaustible our passions may be, I vow to transform them all. However limitless the Dharma may be, I vow to comprehend it completely. Somehow I will manage this. not with my little brain, but somehow I will manage to understand. And now, however infinite the Buddha's truth is, I vow to realize it. So all these vows are huge, and the Dharma is one of those vows. So it's huge. However, not everybody sees it that way. Every now and then I go on a little rant about how the Dharma gets watered down and smalled down and cut down to size to make it comfortable, especially here in the West. This kind of way of just kind of make it nice and just something that I'll do on Sundays or something, you know, just sit twice a day and, you know, I just cut it down and, you know, it's something, becomes sort of a therapy, something to make us feel a little better about ourselves, to have happier relationships and get along better in life, which is all good. But it gets explained and cut up to fit in the closet, you know, and then bring it out when you want it. Actually, I think it's always been this way. I think it's always been the case that there's this human tendency to kind of small things down to make them comfortable, you know, to water down the Dharma in one way or another in whichever way age we happen to live. For us, it's our present way of doing it, to make it convenient. In the time of the Buddha, he's just died, and some monk says, oh, the old sage is dead, now we can do what we want. He was always telling us what to do, now we can do what we like. Immediately, he hasn't even barely drawn his last breath, and somebody says this. So it's been going on for a long time. There's the old saying about the Dharma ending age. You know, the first 500 years after the Buddha's death, you've got pure Dharma. They're okay, they're on track. Then the next 500 years, you've got the counterfeit Dharma, the going off. And then you've got the Dharma ending age. And we're always, it seemed like for the last 1500 years, people have been saying, we're in the Dharma ending age. So this is nothing new. Which is actually comforting in a way. It's not like suddenly we're going to hell in a handbasket and this hasn't happened before. We've always been going to hell in a handbasket, and somehow we stumble along, manage to connect with truth and open up to it. It's a very human thing to want to make things comfortable, you know, something we can manage, something we can handle, to limit our view to something I can actually encompass rather than have something way bigger than I can possibly fathom. But I think we have to keep counteracting this tendency to small it down and make it fit, make it comfortable. It isn't comfortable. The Dharma isn't always comfortable. It's always going to be a little awkward. There's always going to be something that gets you right where you don't want to look at it, something that's, you know. Some aspects worry people, you know. Rebirth. Some people just do not like the idea of rebirth, and they do everything they can to get around it. He didn't really mean rebirth. We can think of it in all these other ways. It's just a cultural thing. The Buddha was just, you know, going along with the culture. I don't think so. I think he had a lot more going for him than that. But it's one of those things that people like to explain away because for some reason it makes them uncomfortable. Just an example. You know, there's lots of things like that. You know, we don't like this, so maybe I'll just kind of squash it into a little, you know, cut that bit off, bung it somewhere else. It's fine not to believe in something. Buddha didn't say believe in everything, but you don't want to disbelieve it and throw it away and say, oh, that doesn't exist, it's just cultural stuff. To put it on the back burner, as Reverend Master would say, to just leave it there. Let it simmer, see what happens to it. You don't have to swallow it yet, and you don't have to throw it away. You know, considering, you know, thinking again about the Buddha, the Dharma nowadays in the West, you read some of these things, books or magazines, and I try to do that a bit just to see, you know, what's happening. I can always learn something. I try to have an open mind, not just sort of think, all modern stuff, what do they know? But to actually read something with an open mind, because I do learn quite a bit. But sometimes I sigh. You know, sometimes, you know, people will write about emptiness or Buddha nature and in ways that sound like really, boy, this person must really know what they're talking about. But actually, you know, we can feel intimidated. I don't know all about Buddha nature and emptiness and stuff. I know very little about it, really. But thinking one knows all about it limits it. We don't know all about Buddha nature and emptiness. You know, we're not that wise. Even if we were really wise, people have very different views about these things. People of great wisdom can argue about things. The Dalai Lama and I think it was Dr. Ratnasara, who was his Dalai Lama senior, Dr. Ratnasara corrected him on a point of doctrine. And the Tibetans got really upset. But the Dalai Lama could be wrong, you know. Nobody's perfect. People have different views. Even people who are deeply wise have been training and teaching and meditating for many, many years. There's still, people have different views or a different way of experiencing something. Nobody has the absolute perfect thing. Maybe the Buddha did. And maybe he made mistakes too. I think he did. But he'll learn. We all learn. I think things like Buddha nature, emptiness, these concepts, they're far greater than any of us could possibly explain or even understand. So I think we need to be a little careful, you know, when we read things, however well-intentioned or however wise they may be, to consider, have a little wise discernment, not just to gulp down everything we read. Oh, this must be really true, it's a written print. But to think, well, who's writing this? Where are they coming from? Is there a feeling of authenticity about it? Is there a sense of humility and honesty and reverence in what they're saying? You know, that reverence. We can get pulled off center when you read things that have cynicism and doubt in them, or some intellectual explanation of the Dharma, or some psychological explanation. None of these completely can hold it. They kind of squash it down a bit. Psychology is fine, but it doesn't explain the Dharma. They're not the same thing. They work, they can help each other, but you can't explain one in terms of the other. And the intellectual explanation can sound satisfying to the brain, but actually doesn't feed the heart. It doesn't nourish us. And when we read things, we need to be a little careful of what we read and how we take it, because you can get the sort of sense of, oh, these people must know what they're talking about. Yes, well, maybe it is like that. And you find it's sort of shrinking down into a little prune. You know, you don't want that. The modern view. There's a whole Korean Zen school whose response to most questions is, don't know. And you sort of think, okay, but actually there's great wisdom in this, because when you don't know something, you really don't know, you leave room to learn, room to hear, room to understand something. There's humility there and respect for something greater. We don't know. We don't know everything. And to be willing to not know, not that we don't learn, but I don't know everything. I don't know that much about emptiness and Buddha nature and all that. We sometimes get a taste of something, it kind of flashes by, or we see it out of the corner of our eye. Sometimes people have a deep experience of Buddha nature, emptiness and all that, but they still can't really explain it. You know, people have been trying for thousands of years. Humility, bowing, reverence for something that's a lot bigger than we are. This is what it is. And this is what we really need to cultivate. That heart of bowing and reverence, something a whole lot bigger than me, something I can't control. We can't fully know the whole of the Dharma. We certainly can't explain it. Even our little life, we are not in charge of our little life, our little brain, our little everything, you know. It's all outside our control. We can't even control what our own body does, never mind everything else. Not trying to have it all tied down, neatly packaged, and smalled down to fit. But to let it be big, and uncomfortable, and untidy, and messy, and take over our life, and be inconvenient, and have to keep precepts that we really don't want to keep, because we've just got to keep them. Even though it's difficult, we don't know how it's going to turn out, to just act in faith, and do what we need, we truly know what needs to, you know, what we need to do, rather than just think, well, it's not in the book, you know. It's untidy. We can't control our life, our training. It takes us where it takes us, you know. That which is a lot bigger than we are, that we don't fully know and we can't explain. Leaving room for this and revering it, bowing to it, it's bigger than we are. This is what Reverend Master Jiyu taught us, what I call Buddhism with a big B. Big room, big hall, big altar, big Buddha. Nothing small about it. Nothing half, no half measures, nothing small down to fit. Big, inconvenient, uncomfortable sometimes. She was very uncomfortable to train with. It was really hard. And yet she dragged us, kicking and screaming, out of our little shells and beyond what we thought we could do. And I'm immeasurably grateful for this. Far more, far bigger than what we had bargained for. Nothing smalled down, nothing made to fit, nothing made convenient, nothing to fit comfortably into our ideas at all. She'd spot them, you know, see somebody with preconception or a thought, or they'd read too much, and she'd just knock it out from under them or get them right where, you know. This sounds unkind, but it wasn't. It was deeply compassionate. She was very kind and very humorous and human. So it wasn't like some horrible, you know, thing. She'd always have a bit of a laugh. But it was not comfortable. Constantly challenging us, making us go beyond what we thought we could do or we thought we could understand. Just pushing us out there, you know. She'd talk about things we had no experience of. And clearly she knew what she was talking about, not from books or, you know, making it up. Absolutely not. She knew from her own experience. And she would warn us over and over again never to bring the Dharma down to our own level of understanding. Always let it be big. We reach up to it. You know, reach up like this. Can't possibly quite get it. But it brings us up rather than us trying to bring it down and make it something we can completely understand and control and do something with. A ceremonial, you know, it points us to this, that which is bigger than ourselves, the bowing, our liturgy, what we recite. We don't understand everything we recite. We bow to it, we look up, we open up, you know, something bigger. Opening up to that which is greater than we are. Bowing with our body when we can, bowing with our heart, whether we can bow with the body or not. Bowing from the heart to that which is greater. While bowing lasts, Buddhism will last. And sometimes, you know, again, in our Western view, sometimes people dismiss ceremonial, think it's not necessary, bowing is kind of weird. You know, descriptive recitation is sort of funny. You don't need that. All you need to do is sit and get wise, you know, or enlightened. And this could be a kind of dismissal of like Asian Buddhists who have been, you know, chanting for pure in the Pure Land practice for hundreds of years, or just doing things in a different way, making offerings. Things that they've been doing for a long, long time because they know that really helps with the reverence, opening the heart, bowing to that which is greater than ourselves. And I think to always remember that, to respect that kind of practice. We don't do Pure Land chanting, but many people do, and it really helps them. Never to dismiss somebody else's practice, thinking it's not really good. Actually, and not to dismiss all our modern Buddhist teachers who are writing about emptiness and all this, because actually they're trying to do their best. There is wisdom in what they say, and some of them have deep understanding, and they're trying to help people. They're writing about these things, not just for personal aggrandizement, but because they actually want to help people to understand. sometimes someone has seen something real and they really want to share it with others, and it doesn't quite come out right because it's difficult, especially when you write it down. And sometimes it does, sometimes it really helps people. And sometimes there's a sense of, you know, cynicism or doubt or smalling down. So one just has to take care. But one can still be grateful for people's effort, people's attempt to help others, but not to let our training or our view or our aspiration get squashed down into something something convenient. Being willing to be made uncomfortable by the truth. Rabbi Master talked about that too, you know, being made uncomfortable by the truth. Okay, back to the Avatamsaka. It's huge, as I said. And its very size and scope can put us off. Like the first 50 pages are about who's there. Well, I tried this, I tried starting at the beginning, and I found it by about page 25. I couldn't take it. Then I learned that actually a better way to approach the Avatamsaka is to jump in somewhere, which is what I did later. The 10 practices or the 10, I forget what they all are, there's 10 of everything. Of 10 of lots of things, and you can just dive and just take one of those little practices or one of those little kinds of conduct and contemplate that, and that works much better, at least for me. Just open the book, look at it. It's really a wonderful thing, full of deep wisdom and full of ordinary common or garden practical advice about generosity, kindness, giving, meditation, how to offer merit to beings, all kinds of simple, mundane practices that we recognize right in there with this really profound view. It's really comforting that actually what we're doing is just what we're supposed to be doing. You know, we're not just doing some little miserable practice over here and the Avatamsaka is this huge thing over there. We're part of that. It's exactly our training, just big, big. And we don't have to read it at all. You'll be happy to hear. You don't have to read the Avatamsaka. It's huge and not cheap. But what we can do is to remember the vastness of its scope, the vastness of the Dharma, to come back to that, to remember that it's all much bigger than we think, much bigger than we know. The vastness that it points to. And that's the most important thing, I think, about the Avatamsaka, is this huge, vast, and deep scope, breadth, depth, height, everything. And to keep bearing in mind that the Dharma is vast and limitless. However limitless the Dharma may be, I vow to comprehend it completely. How am I going to do this? I have no idea. But we can practice it. How we do it is we practice it, putting it into practice. In those mundane little ways, practicing kindness, practicing generosity, doing our meditation, keeping to the precepts. All of these practices are actually extremely profound. They're not just little things. They're really deep. To practice constant kindness to other beings and ourselves, that's a huge practice, actually. It sounds really simple. It's not always easy, but it's something we can do. Generosity, giving our time to people. We talk about this kind of thing all the time. It's not rocket science. We can do it. Even we can do these things. And they're immeasurably helpful. They're really profound. Not to be thought, oh, that's just a simple little thing. Where's the big stuff? You know, it is the big stuff. All these little things that we try to do, bowing as we come into the room, bowing to the Buddha, bowing, as I said, from the heart. It's a really profound practice because it helps us to relinquish our self-importance, our self-concern, our feeling that it's all about me. It's actually not all about me. It's about the bigger thing of which we are just a little part, just little cogs in that huge thing, little cells in that body. It's not about just me and my stuff. It's much bigger. And to keep bearing that in mind, to keep living within that context, coming back to that, That what why the concerns, my suffering, my stuff, my aspirations, my wants, my thing I want next week, my everything, my whole life, my me, is all part, takes place within that big context of something that's much bigger than me. But we're all a part of it. None of us separate for a nanosecond. And that's the hard thing to remember, especially when we're upset. When we're upset, it's hard to remember. I'm actually part of Buddha nature. I'm just a cross part of Buddha nature, but I'm part of Buddha nature. Anyway, it's hard to remember that, you know. We tend to be all separate and cross over here, and everybody else is okay over there, you know. Or we're angry, or, you know, or we're distressed in some way, or we want something. A me arises, a self, a me that wants something or doesn't like this and wants that. And to be able to, even then, try to relinquish the grip a little bit, think, well, you know, none of it's going to last forever. This thing is not going to make me happy forever. This anger is not going to last forever. There's probably a reason that that thing happened. Maybe I can just relinquish the grip a little and just remember, I'm just part of this huge body. Even crabby and upset as I may be, it's all right. It'll pass. I'm not beyond the pale. Reading the Dharma can help. Practicing the Dharma does help, really helps. To keep coming back to it, revering the three treasures, bowing to the three treasures, bowing to the Buddha, bowing to that which is greater than ourselves, constantly. It gives us comfort and courage in our little fragile lives, the little things that happen, the things that go up and down, just to know that great matter that we're part of will sustain us in life and in death and all the other things of our lives. It will sustain us. We're just part of it, not separate for a moment. The vastness of the Dharma. Never to think we're just a little separate me with my little thoughts about, you know, what I'm doing and stuff. But just let it be uncomfortable. Let it be big. Because in fact, it brings great comfort. The true comfort, which is much beyond being comfortable. That true ease of heart that knows we're pointing in the right direction. Even in our stumbling, fumbling way. We're going the right way. Turning the heart to that great matter, the big thing, entrusting ourselves to that, and not being afraid of the vastness, entrusting ourselves to it. That vastness is a comfort because we're part of it, not to worry. That's it. Thank you.